For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark Dugan, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, we'll find out how the Latino vote impacted this year's general election, locally and nationally. We'll preview Arizona's Dust Bowl, an Arizona Public Media original that airs this weekend, right before the Ken Burns documentary, Dust Bowl. We'll hear an interview with musician Steve Winwood about what fans can expect at his show in Tucson this weekend. And on Teacher's Voices, we'll meet substitute teachers Ken and Sue Ravis, who say they teach because they love children. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. The Latino vote has been much talked about, much debated, and much courted this election cycle. But how much do we really know about the bloc we call the Latino vote? And how do politicians really know who they're reaching? Christopher Conover begins our coverage.
During campaign season, it's common for candidates to focus on a particular group. In 1996, we first heard about soccer moms on the presidential stage. This year, it was the Latino vote. Every national campaign tried to reach out to Hispanics, be it in ads like this one.
Y es con esta misma dedicación que luchará para encaminar nuestro país y crear empleos. Los invito a conocerlo y escuchar sus ideas.
Soy Mitt Romney y apruebo este mensaje.
Or on the stump, like when former President Bill Clinton was on the ASU campus campaigning for Senate candidate Richard Carmona.
The reason the DREAM Act is the right thing to do is an answer with two parts. Yeah, there are a lot of Richard Carmonas out there today, and they all deserve their chance at their dreams. But second reason is, this is a big, complicated world, and one of America's great advantages is that we got somebody here from everywhere. And because of the immigrants, we are younger than Europe. We are younger than Japan, and believe it or not, within 20 years, we'll be younger than China.
As ubiquitous as the Spanish language messages were in states like Arizona, political science professor Dr. Susan McManus from the University of South Florida says a single Spanish language ad wasn't enough for campaign outreach.
The more effective Spanish language ads are micro-targeted, just like among other groups in the country. You could do a one-size-fits-all Spanish language ad, but the closer it gets to election day and the more you're really trying to reach small and different slices of the Latino vote, you're better off to run slightly different ones, emphasizing different things and different issues and having different people in the ads themselves.
Dr. John Garcia from the University of Michigan Center for Political Studies says while the so-called Latino vote may have been the hot-button issue during the presidential cycle, it's not new.
This goes back to the Reagan candidacy, who had a conscious Latino outreach program. And in their outreach, they purposely says, if we try to send a message, we need to do it in English. Okay. Now the whole rise of Spanish language media suggests that if you're going to attract this community, you've got to incorporate a Spanish language campaign, not exclusively. It's both to communicate, but it's also a sense of kind of recognition.
But why was the Latino vote the soccer mom catchphrase of this year? Dr. McManus from the University of South Florida says it was a case of demographics.
One of the reasons for the intense interest and increase in interest of the Latino vote was the 2010 census, where there was a lot of publicity about the changing demographics of states. And in states with sizable Hispanic populations, particularly the ones that experienced a lot of growth rate, that got a lot of attention. And of course, anytime you have a high growth portion of the electorate, in this case, Hispanics, you're going to get the attention of the politicians and the parties.
Garcia says backing up the census was a change in voting trends.
Each successive presidential cycle since 2000, the percentage of Latino of the electorate has been jumping almost by 50%. So now I think like 12% or 12.5% of the total electorate are Latino.
But who makes up this growing population known as the Latino vote? Andrea Kelly explores that question.
Eric Hedberg is a faculty associate at Arizona State University and an analyst for the Morrison Institute's Latino Public Policy Center. He has studied the impact of Latino voters on Arizona's elections and how that impact could change in future years. We called him to get his take on the nebulous term Latino vote. We've been hearing about it for months and asked him to explain how a group of millions could be so often talked about as a uniform voting bloc.
I think it's dangerous to sort of say that the Latino vote is one specific type of vote or it's going to go on one specific issue. I think it's more appropriate to say that, you know, Latinos are a microcosm of the diversity of the United States. And so trying to categorize them as a single entity or as a single issue group, I think, is disingenuous.
So why does that happen all the time? We constantly hear about the Latino vote as if it is, in fact, a group of identical people all thinking and voting the same way.
I think that's sort of just the nature of any media or sort of national discussion. I mean, as you have a discussion at a larger and larger aggregate of people, the simpler things have to be for people to remember the discussion and to be able to sort of talk about these issues in a tractable way.
This diverse group of voters makes up 30% of Arizona's population and 25% of the Arizonans old enough to vote. Hedberg says this group is hard to track.
Right now, they're very much an independent group. They tend to break as much independent as they do Democrat. And in the future, we project that they're just going to be even more so. And we need to stress that independent doesn't mean undecided. Independent means that their issues don't fit neatly into either the Republican or the Democrat platforms.
But party preference isn't uniform nationally. Latino voters in Florida are different from Latino voters in Arizona, according to McManus from the University of South Florida.
Here, our Latino population is extremely diverse. And historically, of course, the Cuban vote has leaned more heavily Republican. But the really big surprise of this election season was that the Cuban vote split. And a lot of that is due to the generational replacement of older Cubans who are heavily Republican and much more focused on Cuban foreign policy, whereas younger Cubans much more likely to vote Democratic.
Garcia of the University of Michigan says political involvement also differs among Latino voters.
Those who have naturalized really mid-1990s, but clearly 2000, have been living in a very hostile anti-immigrant environment. So part of the motivation to naturalize is to kind of either survive or protect yourself from legislation that doesn't favor permanent resident aliens. At the same time, so that they're in a politicized climate, and they're naturalizing, so once naturalized, they're more inclined to be politically engaged, politically oriented, vote.
Garcia says in the past, naturalized citizens tended to vote less frequently than native-born Americans, but that pattern is changing among recently naturalized citizens. So how do those who do surveys and exit polling to get a gauge on Latino voters even figure out who to talk to? Hedberg of ASU says it starts with census and marketing data to figure out a geographic area in which to focus. After voters are reached by telephone, pollsters ask them which racial groups they identify with. Surveys of Latino voters, then, are surveys of people who self-identify as Latino. One group trying to register people to vote earlier this year was called Voto Latino. Viva Ramirez, the Arizona field director for Voto Latino, says sometimes that means the only thing Latino voters have in common is a Hispanic surname or that they speak Spanish.
That makes our voting tendencies to be very different from one another.
Ramirez was talking about Voto Latino during a conference call with reporters earlier this year.
Our approach at Voto Latino is not necessarily trying to pinhole a group and then identify a certain demographic and approach them, but to promote the idea that that Latinos are simply Americans, that our issues are American issues, and that they will fall into line with pretty much the rest of America.
Regardless of which political group Latino voters fit into, where they live, or why they vote, the U.S. Census Bureau says one in three Americans are multicultural. For those 18 or younger, it's closer to a 1-to-1 ratio. Hedberg of ASU says in Arizona, the Latino population is also young, which means it will be a bigger proportion of voters in future elections here. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Andrea Kelly.
In the 1930s, much of the United States was being ravaged by the Dust Bowl, a natural disaster brought on by prolonged drought. It was particularly bad for people living in places like Oklahoma and Arkansas. Many of them decided to head west, lured to Arizona by the sunshine and the hope of finding work in the state's bustling cotton fields. The influx of Midwesterners changed Arizona forever, culturally and demographically. Today, we're again suffering the effects of a prolonged drought, leading some to ask, could we suffer another Dust Bowl? This Sunday on PBS 6, we'll premiere the latest Ken Burns documentary, The Dust Bowl. Arizona Public Media has also produced a documentary that looks at the effect of the disaster locally. It's called Arizona's Dust Bowl, Lessons Lost. And here is a short preview.
I am a rambling cotton picker, happy as I can be. Any old cotton patch is home sweet home to me. I have no care like a millionaire, no grief to make me blue. But I pull my sack from day to day and paddle my own canoe. I came out here from Texas to the...
The difference between the Dust Bowl and Arizona was that almost all of Arizona agriculture was irrigated. And most of the agriculture back in the on the southern plains was dry farming. So even though Arizona also experienced a bad drought during the early 30s, it didn't have as much impact on the agricultural sector because that sector was getting its water from the Salt River and other rivers through the Salt River Project or from groundwater pumping.
There's really three things that make Arizona and this region really ideal for production of cotton. One is cotton is a warm season crop. Secondly, there's a salt tolerance that plant has, and in the desert environments, having high salinity levels is natural. And then thirdly, it's really a perennial plant that we grow as an annual in a production setting. And so our long growing seasons, it ties back into that climate, really is conducive to managing and producing that crop.
Cotton has a long history in Arizona. In the 16th century, the first Europeans arrived to find native communities already employing familiar agricultural practices. Arizona's first farmers even built canals and berms to irrigate their crops.
When the Spaniards first encountered these Native Americans in southern Arizona, cotton was one of the crops that they were producing. So cotton was produced along with some other crops like corn, squash, and beans, etc. But it was a major crop in this area even before European settlement. Cotton is oftentimes planted thick in terms of a high population, not knowing what kind of seed quality you have. And you run the insurance with extra planting, extra seed to get a good population, and then the farmers will go back in and thin the crop. That has to be done by hand, again, by hoeing. So that's labor intensive. And then, of course, probably the most labor intensive part is picking, harvesting. So you go through and you start picking these, you know, bowls off into the individual plants. Well, good yield, you'll have, you know, maybe 30, 40 bowls on a plant. Then they dry and then the bowls open up, and as those bowls open up, the burrs are sharp and they stick your hands, they cut your hands. And it had to be done on a timely basis, and it takes a lot of people to do it.
Many of those laborers who had done the backbreaking field work were deported to Mexico.
That created a tremendous demand for labor in the fields that many of those Mexicanos had been fulfilling. And so in that case, they turned to white and black refugees of the Dust Bowl who were, you know, who had been forced off their own land either as owners or as sharecroppers and were trying to survive by driving down Route 66 and heading for Arizona or California.
That's a preview of the Arizona Public Media original production, Arizona's Dust Bowl, Lessons Lost. It airs this Sunday night at 7 on PBS 6, and it's followed by the premiere of Dust Bowl from Ken Burns, which airs at 8. Coming up, we'll visit with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Steve Winwood, who's performing in Tucson this weekend. That's next, here on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. I'm Mark Dugan. Mark McLemore is away this week. Steve Winwood's career spans six decades. He fronted the Spencer Davis Group at age 15. He formed Blind Faith with Eric Clapton in 1969. He was a founding member of the group Traffic, and he had a string of top 40 hits in the 80s. And Rolling Stone magazine ranked him number 33 in its 100 Greatest Singers of All Time list. Come down off your throne. Steve Winwood will play at the Fox Theater in Tucson this Sunday night as part of its second annual Chasing Rainbows Gala. Mark McLemore reached Winwood by telephone recently to talk about his storied career and what fans can expect at this weekend's show.
Tell us, what kind of a show are you going to be bringing with you?
I'm playing with a five-piece band, a band that I've been working with on and off for the last 8 or 10 years. We'll be covering hopefully a wide spectrum of music, going right through from the earliest bands I was in to the music I'm doing now.
So remind our listeners how you began your musical career. How old were you when you first found yourself on stage with a band?
Well, I came from a musical family, and my father played 30s and 40s dance music, and then it was through him and through my brother, then had a jazz band, and I was 5 years younger than he was, but I always nagged them because I wanted to play in the band, and obviously they were all about 16 or 17, and they didn't want an 11 or 12-year-old cramping their style. I sort of persuaded them, and they let me play with them.
And then you found yourself, though, in with the Spencer Davis Group at a young age. When do you remember looking around and thinking, hey, I think I'm a rock star?
Oddly enough, it wasn't immediate, because in those early days, you know, being a musician, it was based on a lot of hard work, playing live and many days spent in the back of a van traveling and doing one-night stands. It didn't perhaps have the glamour that it sometimes does today. Also, I was very much a musician and came to rock and roll really through jazz. So I came in from a slightly unusual direction as well. So it took a while before I realized that perhaps I was a rock star. But it wasn't the ball that they laid into rest. Was the love stock of high heel
boys? You explained that growing up in a musical family did a lot to influence you and to get you going, but where do you think that your soul comes from?
When I was listening to music, I was very interested in listening to music when I was 8, 9, or 10 years old. Also because my brother, who was 5 years older than me, was also very interested in music. And one thing we used to do was we would listen to what was called the BFPO, which was the American Forces Network in Germany. Also, at the same time, there were incredible music that was coming over to the UK from America that we weren't hearing on the radio, but music collectors and record stores and collectors were finding this obscure music, a lot of R&B and blues. And then on top of all that, there was rock and roll, which was just breaking. So we were also hearing early Elvis Presley, Little Richard, and Fats Domino, Jay Lee Lewis, and Buddy Holly. I then got to hear Ray Charles, who I began to model myself on at a very early age, and he's a great hero of mine.
Has your relationship to some of your hits changed over the years as you've maybe you retire them for a little while and bring them back? Do they become old friends, or are some of them kind of become a bit of a burden at this point?
Well, no, not really a burden. Obviously, there are certain songs that audiences like to hear. I've thought of the idea of, on certain shows, just playing music from a certain era. But then I think that has its own shortcomings because, you know, a lot of people come to my show and they want to hear Dear Mr. Fantasy, give us some lovin'. And so it would be quite hard, I think, for me to do just certain shows only playing one era. So I do cover the whole length of my career when I play live. But I do try and rearrange some of the songs so that they stay fresh for the musicians playing them, and that they keep us entertained when we're playing them as well. All of the stuff is good fun to play. We don't play anything that's not fun.
Do you have a favorite instrument with a story behind it?
Well, I did, yes. I think the organ that I played Give Me Some Lovin' on, which was Hammond organ. And then for some reason, later on I got another organ, and that organ disappeared, and I was never quite sure where it went. And then I think it was Ronnie Wood from the Rolling Stones said that he had the organ. I don't know how he got it, but anyway, he had it. And I was very excited. Went and actually saw it, and it wasn't the organ at all. It was another one. It wasn't the organ that I played. It was similar, but it was not the one. So since then, because it's a different model, it wasn't actually a B3, which is what I now play, is the B3. The Hammond organ I was playing in those days was an M100, I think it was called. And so they're much harder to find. I have to confess I do own quite a few Hammond organs. And so I decided I'd go and buy one of these ones, which was the same as the one that I played Give Me Some Lovin' on, although not the exact one.
Well, Steve, I thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve Winwood. Take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
That's Steve Winwood talking to Mark McLemore from his home in England. Winwood plays a show this Sunday night at the Fox Theater Tucson. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight from Arizona Public Media. I'm Mark Dugan.
In cooperation with Tucson Values Teachers, Arizona Public Media presents Teachers' Voices. Substitute teachers can get a lot of jokes made at their expense, but it's important to remember that some educators who are working as substitutes are actually continuing teaching careers that can be backed by decades of experience. Two semi-retired teachers who continue to contribute to educating Arizona youngsters are Bob and Sue Ravis, and next they talk to each other about the experience.
You remember how things were back when we first started teaching?
Yes. Yes, it was very different.
Well, we had chalkboards and reel-to-reel projectors, and now we have computers and smart boards, so it's gone quite a ways.
Yep.
Getting out of the College of Ed and at NAU and starting to teach, I had an excellent education from NAU, but there was so much to learn once you got into the classroom. It's not stuff that you could teach in the university classrooms. It's stuff that you have to learn just by doing.
Well, I remember when I started out my first year, it was sink or swim. You were put in that classroom and there was not any on-the-job training or mentoring, and it's changed a lot. Now teachers, when they start out, have training in classes and they have mentors assigned to them and they get a lot of guidance, which I would have really loved to have had in those early years. I think back too, I remember when I started out in the mid-70s, Arizona was about middle of all the states.
In per pupil.
Exactly, in per pupil funding. And we used to, my friends and I, other teachers used to sort of ridicule the states at the bottom. And guess what? Now we're at the bottom and those states are higher than we are.
Well, your mother started teaching in Coolidge in the 50s, and she was actually, at that time, Arizona valued good teachers so much that we would actually put ads in the New York Times and other papers back east for teachers.
The teachers in Arizona were some of the highest paid teachers in the country, and my mother had an interview by phone from New York State and was hired and came out sight unseen. to Arizona to teach, but they recognized that they needed to attract good teachers, and they were willing to pay for it.
And they did. Your mom was an excellent teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to the way things are today, there's so much more expectations on the students. We're having to teach to the test, and it takes the personal touch out of teaching. There's so much more stress on the kids. And on the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And the incentives for the kids to want to be there are not there like they used to be. And it's very hard to do some of the educational fun stuff we used to do unless it fits some certain specific criteria that has to be met for the state standards. And so we're in such a lockstep now with what we have to teach, teaching to the test, getting the kids ready for yet another test.
Right. Not all students progress at the same rate. They're not all ready for what is being tested. And I know I've always loved all my students. I just, when they're assigned to me, they just are mine. And it doesn't matter how great their needs are and how obnoxious their behavior, I could always see the potential in every child and always wanted to help them meet their potential and make progress, and always wanted to do the best for them, regardless. I just loved them all. They were all mine.
Yeah, there's never been an end of the year party where I didn't have to conceal a few tears, because you see these kids for every day for 7 hours a day, 180 days a year, and then last day, they're gone.
Yeah,
and they're not your kids anymore, and then
it's hard to say goodbye at the end of the year.
If I were starting over and choosing teaching as a profession again, I'd do it again. Just because I love the kids so much. It's so rewarding to see the growth year after year.
I think when you're a teacher, you're a teacher. It's something that's in your core, and you do it because that's what's important to you, and that's what you are, and even in spite of the pay.
It's kind of hereditary for us.
Yeah, it was definitely hereditary.
We came from a family of teachers.
Our parents and our siblings are teachers. And
it was in the blood.
Yeah, yeah. But the teachers in Arizona work really hard, and I think we've seen the results.
That was happily married Bob and Sue Ravis, both semi-retired educators who have helped to teach a generation of Arizona kids.
Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM studios and is engineered by Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. Mark McLemore will be back next week. I'm Mark Dugan, and this is Arizona Spotlight from Arizona Public Media.